This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You just missed a riveting conversation about diapers and constipation. But this is what has come to, Dave. This is the period of life that we're in.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my guest co-host, a man who predicted the end of the Kardashian wedding months ago, Dave DeShriver.
I predicted it 1 hour into the live broadcast.
Yes.
I think this thing was doomed. My wife loved the event. Something about it was just suspicious. Mm-hmm. No? Is that just me?
From the beginning. Was this just a media event?
No, impossible.
So how did she, but how did they make, did they make money off this, you know, media
You were televised
spectacle?
Live for how many hours? What? Wasn't it so
I know, but who pockets the money in that case? I mean, other than the television channels.
Commercials.
I know,
Google
but where
money?
Does that money end up? Does that just end up on the on MSNBC? Or I'm saying, is Kim Kardashian somehow making money off her own wedding?
But she's making a ton of money off her own wedding. Or maybe they have a philanthropy or a grant I don't know about. Is this education related?
I have no idea.
I'm trying to tie it back.
You're working it. You're trying to tie it back. So we should warn our audience here. Both of Dave and I are a little sleep deprived. Dave has a 4-month-old at home. You just missed a riveting conversation about diapers and constipation. But this is what has come to Dave. This is the period of life that we're in.
Right. If you hear this sound, that just means I fell asleep on the microphone.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll just throw some cold water on you and get you.
Appreciate
going.
It.
All right. Keep pumping that coffee.
Right.
Come on. You still got half more of that cup to go.
Got depth charge here.
All right. Hey, exciting times in education. Things are happening. We got NAEP. We got reauthorization moving finally. So let's get in there. We're going
to
start.
I'm excited to be in 2007. You know, it's good to be here. Oh, wait. This is what? Not 2007?
We are further than we were in 2007, Dave.
Right,
we have surpassed that 2007, and we are now heading into the future.
Right, far is this the bridge Clinton talked about?
This is the bridge.
Good.
This is it. Okay, Daniela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Great. Question number one. The 2011 Nation's Report Card released this week, marking modest gains at the 8th grade level and in 4th grade math. What should we make of the results?
So, you know, we always have to do the disclaimers, right? We can't draw any causal inferences from the results. None of us really have a clue. It's like looking at the weather. We don't know what causes it. Okay, set that aside. One thing was we got upticks. I mean, tiny little upticks, you know, 1 point basically in fourth grade math and eighth grade reading and eighth grade math. Now, I think what's most interesting is the eighth grade reading. This is an area where we have not seen much progress before. Again, it's just a tiny little uptick, but it's optimistic. Here's my glasses half full reading on this. You ready, Dave?
I'm ready.
Reading first and other scientifically based reading initiatives. You know, the kids who are in eighth grade today would have been in first grade in 2004, right? You do that math, okay. That was really right when Reading First was really being implemented full bore. And people were getting religion on scientifically based reading research. And at the time, there was concern that we weren't seeing gains in eighth grade scores. And, E.D. Hirsch and others argued this was because, okay, you can teach a kid to decode, but that doesn't mean they're actually learning to read. They need content for that. Well, it turns out perhaps that these kids that are reading better because of their decoding better because of those skills back then, that they've continued and they're making progress now as eighth graders.
Well, there's a lot of other trends. What about the Harry Potter effect? You have parents who are reading Harry Potter books to their children, so maybe it was the parental reading to the children in conjunction to early learning reading.
Yes, the elusive Harry Potter theory.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah,
and I would like to just lay over the possibility, if you look at the increase in e-books, which may have propelled reading to children, I think there's a possible connection to technology, e-books, and this spike.
There's always this question about, you know, texting and whether or not this is helping or hurting the literacy cause. In fourth grade reading, we see flat scores. This is now continued. We have flat scores now for something like three iterations of this test.
Right.
We saw, again, some big bumps up during the early days of the Reading First time, and then it seems to plateau. You know, if there's anything that is related to family background stuff, what's going on at home, it would be fourth grade reading. This is the stuff that is most influenced by what happens before kids are in school.
Right.
So you could say that perhaps this is, you know, showing signs of the economic hardships on families, that they're more stressed out. Kids are not making the progress in fourth grade reading that they once were. I'm going way out on a limb here,
right,
Dave. Again, disclaimer. honestly, I don't have a clue what these scores
mean. Well, what's going on with the parental engagement, if you look back in time, as you were saying, for the reading first, what's the role of parental engagement in reading to the parents in this program?
Well, you know,
so now we're seeing the echo of that.
Well, let's dig in. You know, we can dig into the results, and we'll do this week here at the Fordham Institute to see the trends for things like what kind of reading is happening, kids reporting how much they read for fun, how much TV they're watching, stuff like that. See if there's any
grind out some regressions.
And we'll grind something out, yeah. Or regressions. Why don't you even get that fancy? I'm just going to like look at the data and be like, psh, look at that. There's a trend.
Right, right.
That's how we roll, Dave. That's how we roll. So that's where you got it. Now, the other thing to look for, of course, is the state results. And here, you know, it was a big surprise. Guess which state did really well across the board? Hawaii.
Hawaii, well across the board.
Now, the funny thing here is that everybody has said that it's a joke that Hawaii won race to the top. And that,
poor
in fact,
Hawaii's
their implementation's been very lackluster. That people are saying, take the money away from Hawaii, and then it comes out, boom, with the grand slam, making progress in all subjects, all grades. Gotta love that.
What a great story for Hawaii, no?
Yeah, yeah. I know. So I think that's going to give Hawaii some breathing room.
What do we know about lackluster performers?
In terms of states, it looked like, I don't think anybody, well, only a few lost ground. You know what, I'm remembering this off the top of my head. Missouri, not looking so good. Mm. There were a couple others that were not looking so good.
Tough economic
some of the
times in Missouri,
you know,
too.
Some of the leading states, Massachusetts continue to make some progress in some areas. No signs of progress for Texas or Florida. So look for that, at least in overall scores. Okay, Daniela, what's next?
Question number two. Much ado has been made about the rollback of federal accountability provisions and the proposed ESEA reauthorization bills floating around. What should we make of the unlikely GOP union partnership?
So, Dave, we haven't been together since the big Harkin-Enzi bill made it out of committee with some interesting amendments. You've been writing about this, as have I.
The mothership has launched.
The mothership has launched. So I've been telling people now I think there's a 50-50 chance of this thing getting done before the election.
That's a bold prediction. Nice.
I like to be out on the edge.
Yeah.
Do not forget, I said Kathy Black would be gone by Easter, and she was.
Okay. We'll credit you that.
Thank you. It's the first time I ever got anything that right. Okay. What do you think? What's your take? Is this thing moving ahead? I mean, look, we've got the contours of a bill are in sight, right?
We have the contours of the bill, but we're still stuck on a lot of policy details. We're stuck on the politics and how that's going to play out. And we don't know what the House is going to do. So there's a lot of activity still to play out. We have a path. So I'll grant you that. We have a path. It's likely to be the ultimate shape of what we see, right? We're looking at intervening in the bottom 5%. What I'm really interested to learn about is how we are going to measure continuous improvement. And I think that's going to be the crux of the debate going forward.
And this is the language in the Harkin-Enzi bill that says that states basically have free reign to design their own accountability systems, but they got to do annual testing. They got to have some way of looking at subgroups, and all students and the subgroups have to be asked to make continuous improvement.
Right. And so we're moving towards an era where we're going to have more data transparency, reporting, accountability. And so if we have this measure of continuous improvement, how does that connect to the reporting?
Yeah.
How does that connect to the communication, what's happening to the communities and the schools?
All right. But see, Dave, you're that's making the assumption that Harkin-Enzi language is going to stay in there. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. It's going to change.
It's going to.
So there's going to be a tremendous activity around that language.
And so what's, you know, you look at the Alexander bills, which were the Republican Senate proposal, and there you have even less language. They basically say, hey, states have to design an accountability system. It's got to, you know, consider subgroups in some way.
Right.
That's basically it. And I think that's mostly likely where the House is going to come out, because the House is going to come out, you know, to the right of Harkin-Enzi. So if anything, I think that Alexander language is most likely to get in there. You know, as for the civil rights groups, the lefty reformers, the editorial pages that are screaming bloody murder because they want accountability language that talks about having annual targets, which, by the way, is not that. I mean, these differences are pretty small and nuanced in my view, but they want these annual targets. I don't see how it's possible that it's going to get back in there at this point. I mean, it's not going to happen on the Senate floor. Nobody's going to pass an amendment making it tougher accountability, and the House isn't going to put it in. So I think game over on that one, folks.
You think politically it's going to go forward, though? Do you think the Republicans would let Obama sign a reauthorized ESEA prior to the election?
Yeah, a reauthorized ESEA that is in line with the Republican principles? Yes.
Ooh, that's giving Obama a lot before an election. That's my big concern.
Because this election is really going to turn on the issue of ESEA reauthorization.
Anything. Boy, they get into the weeds all the time.
All right. Well, I don't know. I'm optimistic or naive. You take your pick. Okay, Daniela, next question.
Ava Moskowitz is attempting to open a new charter school in the middle-class neighborhood of Cobble Hill and is being met with some fierce resistance. Is there a place for charters like hers in middle-class America?
How dare she? Really? I mean, my God. This is a comfortable suburb, right?
I don't know about suburb, but yes, urban hamlet. How about that?
Oh, that's well put, urban hamlet.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, I think it comes down to the same question that is at the heart of any school reform, and that's culture. If you're going to make dramatic changes, you're going to have to fight the culture of the existing location. And if it's an urban hamlet, the culture is going to be more deeply seated. It's going to be tougher to move.
See, here's what I see happen in some of these urban areas. You've got the issue of gentrification, right? So you've got these neighborhoods where a lot of wealthier people have moved in. They've started sending their kids to public schools. And for those families that have said, hey, we're going to all get together and send our kids to the neighborhood public school, that only works for them if they get most of their other upper middle class neighbors doing the same. And so a charter school comes in that might end up peeling off some of these parents. They get real worried because suddenly their plan to, you know, revitalize their public school, i.e. push all the poor kids out, isn't going to be as successful. This is happening on Capitol Hill, too, where there's talk, you know, that next year there's going to be a new charter school, the Basis School. People are worried that it's going to be very attractive to middle-class, upper-middle-class families. And so for some of the schools on Capitol Hill that have gentrified and have more of those families, that they're going to get, those are going to get peeled off.
So you're worried about the creaming effect here.
So it's interesting. I mean,
what about the sports teams? I think that's probably a more compelling argument.
Well, that's true, too. You're right. Maybe that's what
academics, whatever. There's like a legacy of a sports team in the area, and I bet that they want to keep that intact.
But I'm not talking just academics, Dave. I'm talking about something much more fundamental. I'm talking about the mix of kids in a school.
Right.
Okay? If you are, you know, upper middle class, sending your kid to the neighborhood school, you want that school to have as many other upper middle class kids as you can. All right? They won't talk about it, but that's what they mean. And they worry that some of those other upper middle class parents are going to peel off and go to a charter school. That's going to screw up their agenda for creating an upper middle class public school. And look, I'm not saying this is nefarious, okay? People do this all the time. Most upper middle class people move to the suburbs or go private for exactly this reason. So I think this is what's happening here is that there was one path that some parents were on via the public school route, and the charter school thing throws a wrench into their plans. But that doesn't mean it's a bad idea. The point here is to say, hey, these are densely populated areas with lots of kids, many of whom are not getting well served. And if somebody can come in with a better school and a different idea and a different approach, let them do it and see if the parents want to go for it.
Well, I think it's a great idea. I hope Eva is successful. I think she's going to be swimming upstream on this one. She's a tough swimmer, though. I think she can do it.
Thank you, Dave. All right, Daniela, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Next up is everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
So this is a special Research Minute. It's more like a China talk.
It is. Hopefully I'll get more than 1 minute.
And I do hope that the song we're going to play later is My Little China Girl.
I like that one.
I like it too. All right, so Amber, straight back from China, 10 days
Woo,
over there.
Still jet lagged, baby.
Yeah, I bet you are.
Yeah, waking up at 3:30, wide awake, not being able to go back to sleep. But anyway, I'm still here.
Well, I hope you serve yourself some dim sum when that happens.
Yeah.
So you went over there with this global
policy group. It's got some other word in there, but you get the idea.
And you got to go do some sightseeing, but also go see lots of schools, learn about the Chinese system. Mm-hmm. Now, our own checker, Finn, had warned you before you left that they're going to give you a dog and pony show.
Yes.
They're going to just show you the best. That's they're not going to let you see the underbelly.
Sad to say he's right. Drives me crazy when he's always right. Yes. But yes, we got to see the best of the best. The best private schools and the best public schools, and many times you couldn't tell the difference whether it was public or private. So they were all top notch.
Yes. All right. Well, let's talk about a couple of things. You've been writing about some of this on the blog, and some things have caught my eye in particular. First of all, governance. Right. Mm-hmm. We're getting interested in this topic at Fordham Big Conference on December 1st about the issue here in D.C. You know, there's some reformers who might not want to admit it, but might daydream and say, if we only had a dictatorship, benign, if that. We could get all of these policies through, but this fragmented government of ours makes it so hard. So China, Communist Party runs a show. is this help them run a good education system?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some pros and cons. I mean, obviously, and I even say we've got a little editorial this week where I kind of go into depth about this. But I mean, I think obviously one advantage is, yes, you can kind of push through. I mean, i.e. they have, you know, this common college entrance exam that all kids have to take. So what they're taught is obviously fairly structured. I think there are some good, I mean, lots of advantages, but bottom line, you know, they obviously don't value individual rights. So in some cases, teachers are being moved to other schools, maybe where they don't want to be moved to. But the state says, you know, it might be in our best interest to have our better teachers teach these certain kids, whether they be the high achieving kids or the lower achieving kids. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in some ways you see some advantages, but also obviously, you know, there are some provinces particularly who are calling for more freedom. And in some cases, the state is granting that. So you're seeing some, I guess, some a little bit of chipping away at what the state's been able to do in terms of calling the shots, but not too much chipping away, only as much chipping as a state's willing to be chipped.
So you go into a classroom in China. Does it look like what you'd see here in the United States?
So, I mean, I think in many ways it's just sort of reflected what I've heard through the years and what many folks have heard about Asian education. The kids are sitting in rows. And the schools I visited, they're in school uniforms. And the teacher,
which, by the way, look like tracksuits.
They did. They look like tracksuits. The teacher walks in. They stand up, which is a nice little, you know, respectful gesture. And she continues to basically ask a ton of questions, all of which appear to be recall. And kids listen, and they respond in unison as a group, at least in the classes that I observe. So
she's not asking them how they feel about this or that.
No, she's
creative ideas.
She's pretty much asking recall, you know, kind of, you know, are you following me? What's the answer to that? I mean, obviously it's in Mandarin, so I'm sure my best guess is that it was recall. But yeah, just, you know, that is just classic direct instruction in the best sense. But kids are wide awake. I wasn't bored. These kids, I mean, the teachers in many ways act like entertainers. You know, they're enthusiastic. The kids are often laughing, so they're injecting some humor in there. Mm-hmm. I saw one.
You're not sure they might have been making fun of you, but
they could have. Anyway, yeah, I gotta say, with blonde hair, you're kind of a freak show in Shanghai, Beijing, and Xi'an. So
that's very good. And these classes, I understand, had upwards of 50 kids in them.
50 kids. Yeah, I just kept counting and recounting. And yeah, it was like 47 in one. It was 52 in one. So 45 in another.
But I guess the kids are so well behaved. Classroom management
no
problems.
No classroom management. And when you ask Chinese teachers about discipline problems, they look at you like you've got three heads, you know. And then one teacher said, well, we don't talk about discipline in class. Class is for classroom instruction. You know, it's like, oh, okay.
Now, I understand that there's some people in China who would like to move away from this rote instruction. They mm-hmm. they look at the United States. I understand, you know, Steve Jobs died while you were over there. Obituaries everywhere, mm-hmm. revered. And the refrain in China was, we want our own Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do they think they're going to make that happen?
Yeah, so Premier Wen has come down with basically a list of reforms that they'd like implemented for 2020, one of which is teaching more creativity in classes and more basically constructivist type of learning. And the teachers are wanting to do it. You know, they're like, okay, it's coming down from the state. This has got to be a good thing. But I don't think that they know what to do with that. You know, they're struggling. In some cases, you'll see little examples where kids will work in groups, but you get the sense that they still don't exactly know how to do this because most of them didn't go to ed schools. Most of them don't know pedagogy. They just know, you know, I'm the expert here and I'm supposed to tell the kids what I know. So I think it's really kind of one of those precarious situations where it's not exactly clear how this is going to be implemented. And in some cases, they have classes on creativity, which kind of is...
Well, what's not clear to me is that they're at all taking the right lessons from America. I mean, yes, we produce a lot of creative people and entrepreneurial people. I don't know how much credit our schools get, or at least what happens during the school day. I mean, I would say that perhaps our extracurricular activities deserve some credit for that, building confidence and a can-do attitude. And there might be some schools that do it well during the school day, but it just seems like it's more a part of our culture, right? I mean, for better or for worse, we don't have kids show as much respect for authority. Mm-hmm. And while that's not fun for teachers much of the time, it does make for people who are more willing to question and think differently and go out there and find, you know, create a better mousetrap. And yeah. That's not necessarily all happening in our schools.
Yeah, and I think, right, the same can be said of China, right? It's not exactly what's going on in classrooms. It's that when the kids go home, the parents are saying, okay, you know, you need to be doing 3 hours of homework. And this test that you're going to take in ninth grade is going to determine whether you even go to high school, much less college. So, you know, they've got many more individual, you know, consequences for kids than we can even dream about having in this country. So.
No, and they say, and by the way, you are my Social Security, my son. Uh-huh. So everything is riding on you getting in, getting these good test scores, getting into these colleges so that we can have an okay retirement someday.
That's right. Exactly.
All right. So thank you, Amber, for joining us on our special China Talk.
All right. It was a pleasure.
I still think that Amber was over there as a spy.
You know what she didn't do?
What?
Totally unrelated.
Yeah.
She didn't plank on the Great Wall. Have you seen this phenomenon?
What?
I saw pictures of someone planking.
Really?
On the Great Wall.
No, I haven't seen this.
Amber,
you mean like the yoga pose?
Where was she? She was in the square on the Great Wall. She could have planked at any one of these locations.
The soldiers? Those...
the clay soldiers?
The clay soldiers, right.
Yeah. She could have planked on top of the soldiers.
Exactly. You mean plank, like the yoga move? Like
I don't think so.
What are we talking about? What do you mean plank?
Talk about the internet phenomena of planking. Have you not seen this?
What does this mean? No.
How do I describe? Any assistance here? So you basically get stiff as a board
yes.
and lodge yourself into very awkward and maybe embarrassing and possibly illegal positions.
Oh, interesting.
No, it's not illegal, then not sanitary.
This is like people used to do the gnome thing in interesting places.
Right.
Now,
right.
This is
now the planking thing has gotten out of control.
I see. I'll have to check that out.
Right.
Yeah. All right. I'll give Amber a hard time about that now that I know what it is. Okay. It is now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you want to chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What's up with that?
Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. It's an interesting conversation you guys were having about planking.
Yeah, you've done some?
I haven't. I'm actually into the new phenomenon, which is T-bowing. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but...
T-bowing?
Yeah. T-bowing, as in Tim Tebow, the quarterback, formerly from Florida, now at Denver Broncos. He, instead of celebrating after big plays, he goes down and puts his head on his fist while on one knee after big plays and thanks God. And so the new phenomenon...
Does he pose or does he thank God?
Up in the air.
That's between him and his creator.
Which is more important, his biceps or his spirituality?
I'm not sure, but...
His strong jaw, maybe.
It sounds like the thinking man, but it's really the praying man.
It's exactly like the thinking man, but it's now been deemed the Tebow, and people have been striking the pose in crazy positions and taking pictures of it.
This is like the Heisman.
I'm sticking with that plank. I refuse to participate in T-bowing.
Okay, all right. Well, we've all got our thing. Okay, Chris, what you got for us this week?
Well, I've been writing this segment for about a year now, but never before have I been as flabbergasted as I was after seeing this article. Ohio gym teacher Stacy Schuler was charged with 16 counts of sexual battery for sleeping with her male students, all, perhaps not coincidentally, members of the football team. As sad as it is for me to say this, the sex with the student story is a bit trite at this point, happening way too frequently for any individual case to stand out from the rest, except for this one. Among claims that Schuler's judgment was inhibited by her alcoholism and use of antidepressants, her lawyers went on to state that her actions could also be explained by her vegan diet in case of irritable bowel syndrome. I'd go ahead and ask what's up with that, but I'm pretty sure in this case it's implied. I'm just trying to picture the desperate conversation that took place in her lawyer's office prior to the trial. How long did it take them to arrive on the conclusion that, well, it looks like our best shot at winning this thing will be to tell the judge your super vegan diet and blistering case of IBS made you so crazy you thought it was okay to sleep with those players. So I guess the lesson learned here is to keep an eye out for the vegans in your community? To no one's surprise, the judge didn't buy Schuler's defense that the veganism and irritable bowel syndrome made her crazy enough to sleep with the students and sentenced the sex deviant to 4 years in jail.
And 16 counts, does that mean she slept with 16 football players?
They didn't get specific, but I think the number Joe says is five. Five players.
So
multiple incidents, apparently.
I can picture one of these, you know, commercials that you see for the pharmaceuticals, you know, do you have irritable...
IBS.
Do you have IBS? Well, are you having pain in your abdomen? Are you lusting after children that you shouldn't be having sex with?
Well, here's the thing that gets me. For, as a defense, are you arguing that IBS... is somehow not a barrier to sexual encounters? Like, this is an attractive... Is this condition led to a sexual engagement of any kind? I think these football players had their sense at all. Forget it.
I surely hope they weren't arguing it was the stimulant in this case, but...
Wow. Yeah, I guess this story does stand out, huh?
In multiple ways, yes.
So in 4 years, I mean, is that enough? Is that, I'd be kind of curious to know, like, look, for a male...
Probably not, no.
I mean, look, and the question is this double standard, right? If a male teacher had done this, it seems like the penalty might have been much worse. So maybe we'd have to look into that. You know, look, male teachers have to be very afraid all the time of any kind of allegations, of any impropriety, you know, looking at a student the wrong way. I mean, I have friends who are teachers, and they're like, look, I just maintain eye contact at all times, you know? I mean, somebody wants to come up and give me a hug. I'm like, no, I can't. I mean, very, you know, because if you're a male teacher, especially teaching in high school, this is what's going to end your career, right? So, you know, you sleep with five boys and you only get 4 years? I don't know. I would say that if this was the other way around, a man sleeping with five teenage women, he'd be locked up for a long time.
I concur.
I certainly don't think if the man had irritable bowel syndrome, it would really play out this way. But
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's probably right.
Yeah, good insight.
All right. Thank you. That's all we have for today. You know, the problem with these stories, trite though they are, is they all lead us into the gutter and we just have nowhere to go but down. So, but nice work.
A great way to end the show.
I blame the media on that. It's not our fault.
Thank you, Dave. That's right. All right. Well, that's all the time we've got today. Until next time.
I'm Dave Shriver.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.